Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Matthew Rand, sitting in for Ann today. Although Twitter is far from the biggest social network, it is second to none in terms of the influence it has over public opinion. But following Elon Musk's takeover, a collapse of the platform could be a real possibility. Wired contributor Eve Fairbanks recently wrote about the true cost of a Twitter implosion. You can find a link to her story on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Eve Fairbanks, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to join you.
Yeah, glad to have you. And it's certainly been a tumultuous few weeks here for Twitter, to say the least, right? Catch us up, just what's been going on. And I'm curious to kind of hear about your personal experience using this platform in the last few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, the app feels kind of like a black box right now. I mean, we know what the owner, what Elon Musk says is happening, and you know, some other reporting, but it's just kind of unclear. You hear from people that their user experience is different. I myself have had a certain type of bot claiming to be an elite business professor, offering me great Bitcoin opportunities, kind of like gumming up my posts.
Oh, great.
And awesome. So it's hard to tell what's going on. And you know, that's not so different. It occurred to me that a lot of publishing companies are private companies, the New York Times, a lot of book publishers. They also have no obligation to share data about how their businesses are doing. I think it's different with Twitter though, because people who use Twitter feel like they've made Twitter, and they have. So, you know, it's odd to be in this experience of an owner now who didn't necessarily want to even own the platform, who's very singular, who's very up and down, back and forth, and in what his goals are, what his aims are. It's like being on a giant boat with a very strange and opaque captain, which wouldn't make anybody comfortable. You know, I'm a journalist. I've been a journalist for 15 years in Washington and then in Southern Africa. And it was interesting to write this long feature piece that I did for Wired on what Twitter really came to mean to a lot of people and communities, because I am not a huge Twitter user compared to some other journalists. But I actually had an attitude that some people have, which is kind of an irritation that Twitter exists, and an irritation when you're asked to sort of promote stories of yours on Twitter, feeling like it's a time suck. But when I really thought about it and thought about just the thought experiment, and this won't happen, but if we all just woke up and there were no more Twitter, of course, the immediate feeling that some people have is thank heavens, right?
You know,
I won't be so distracted. I won't sit on the toilet and look at Twitter. It really, it's A, had just a huge impact on journalism of all kinds that I think can almost only be underestimated. And that means that it has a huge effect on people who don't even think that they're affected by Twitter. I was thinking about my mother, who really became a big fan of ex-president Donald Trump. And she also became a big doubter of the COVID-19 vaccine. And she got that from Twitter, even though she doesn't use Twitter, because of the way radio hosts that she liked cite Twitter. So the way that it drives ideas, it drives our sense of what's important in terms of events is absolutely, it way outstrips the number of people who are really active users of Twitter. And just the last thing I would say, is that I also think that some Americans, I've lived for a dozen years in sub-Saharan Africa, are not totally aware of how important, how vital Twitter has become to certain countries, especially certain particular ones that have repressive regimes. Twitter, because of the anonymity, because of the ease of making a post, you don't have to pay for cell phone data to upload a picture or a video. It's very easy, it's convenient. that is where, in for example, Zimbabwe, it is where political discussion takes place. It's where organizing takes place. It's where the political life of the country really kind of happens. And so, you know, that is something that now you have the prospect of a person who, for a while, didn't seem to want to own the platform. He's holding that country in his hands, in a sense. And that I find, I don't know, worth just contemplating and kind of takes my breath away when I really think about it.
You're listening to All Sides Tech Tuesday. I'm Matthew Rand, sitting in for Ann Fisher today, and we're talking about a possible Twitter implosion and the takeover of the company by Elon Musk. My guest is Eve Fairbanks. She is a Wired contributor who's recently written about the true cost of a Twitter implosion. You can find that link, a link to that story on our website, wosu.org/allsides. And Eve Fairbanks, we're talking about this risk of a Twitter implosion. How likely is that? What would that look like?
I don't think it's likely at all that it would implode, as in, you know, we all wake up one morning and there's no Twitter. But I do think that, you know, it's in the hands of quite a capricious owner and someone who seemed to have bought it because he wanted it. He wanted owning it to say something about him. And if it starts to have a lot of hiccups, if it starts to degrade, he could lose interest. And you could have a situation where it slowly becomes less usable. The feed is weird. People are, you know, having a lot of bugs, and it starts to feel like something quite rickety and that people don't necessarily want to be a part of. But I think that will happen slowly, and it'll be, I sometimes think like the sort of fantasy that it'll just explode like in a glorious fireball. We'll just wake up and it won't be there. We kind of want that because it absolves all of us from having to make a decision about what point we might want to leave because it doesn't seem ethical to be on it. It's not useful. But, you know, I think, I sort of think the most likely thing is that it'll slowly degrade over months, even years.
Well, yeah, and you talk about, you know, what's the alternative, right? Are there other platforms that are a viable alternative to Twitter right now? Are we all going to be on Mastodon or one of these other sort of third party players out there in 6 months? Is that likely?
I think it's an interesting opportunity to think about where we want to be and what we want that platform to look like. I do think that it's easy to overstate how simple a kind of mass transfer of social capital, of connections, of communities. You know, I talk a little bit in the piece about urban planning Twitter, which is a kind of vibrant academic community that's really been built up on Twitter. And I don't think those can just be ported over so easily, especially to platforms where the barrier to entry is higher, like TikTok. You have to make a video.
You write extensively about the negative impact, right, that Twitter has had on journalism specifically. But on the other hand, it's also enabled phenomenal reporting by people who never would have been heard in the old publishing system. How do you view this from, you know, 30,000 feet up, the impact of Twitter on journalism?
Let me go with the positive first,
Great.
because it's maybe smaller. But I do think that I wrote that Twitter comes alive in real once in history moments, or you know, really big moments like the protests over the murder of George Floyd, like even recently the rapid collapse of the crypto exchange FTX. You get a kind of conversation in real time. And people being able to add things from having little bits of inside knowledge and quilting together a sense of almost witness. You know, people can kind of feel like they're really experiencing these events. And that can be really amazing. I mean, some of the best reporting on recent events in crypto has been done by people who run anonymous accounts who don't use their real name. They're not sort of traditional journalists. On the other hand, in terms of traditional journalism, and a lot of, all New York Times reporters now use Twitter, I think it's totally exacerbated a kind of inequality of reach in ideas. I know in my case, and many other journalists who don't have millions of Twitter followers, you are told and you start to think that you should be tweeting or even writing pieces in order to grab the attention of a very, very small set of super user journalists who have like a million followers, because that's how you get, that makes the diff that makes all the difference in kind of viralness, momentum. And there's been some interesting academic studies that most people who use Twitter don't really realize how small the set of super users that really drive conversations is. As in, it's a couple of hundred people
Yeah.
across politics, whatever. And we're all in journalism, you have then tens of thousands of writers, all with their different perspectives, and podcasters, and all kind of attempting to get the attention of that small set. And so that's just been a really extreme impact. And it's also made the discourse very static, because those people can't be unseated. They can't really be fired, even if they're suspended. When they come back, all their followers come back. A lot of people say, why does it seem like, I don't know, our political arguments, they just go in circles, they don't progress, they just feel really static. I actually think that Twitter is a not insubstantial part of that.
Yeah, like you were saying about your mother, right? Where it's like this idea, and I don't want to put her on the spot, but like this idea that even a tw people who aren't Twitter users still get still feel the influence of this of ideas that propagate through Twitter. And like you said, it's just a small handful, really, of the world population that is sort of driving this conversation.
That's absolutely true.
And
And Twitter, I mean, one can feel, I got in an argument with a friend of mine who said, no, it's citizen journalism. There's such a long tail of great citizen journalists. There is a great long tail of citizen journalists, but especially when there's not a kind of breaking live event where people on the ground locally can contribute in a really special, unique way. Much more than we even feel like we're experiencing, we're actually listening to a really small set of people on Twitter.
you call Twitter a virtual civilization. What do you mean by that? And what would it mean if that civilization disappeared?
Oh, it has its own norms. It has, ways to achieve more status, ways of relating within this kind of world. It has exports. It has an impact on other places. The ideas generated there are exported. I really think of it as a virtual civilization. And what will happen to it? My sort of theory is that it'll be a more dramatic change for both bad and good than the kind of jokey, memey, Elon sucks, kind of funny way we're talking about it right now. It would be a really, really big loss, and not entirely a loss that we should grieve necessarily, but a loss, just an abs a sort of ending of something. And I assume that people will find other ways to be on social media, but in terms of the way that one can experience breaking news events in places where people don't have a lot of Wi-Fi data that Americans rely on, places like Ukraine and Zimbabwe, that we can receive information on Twitter in a way that other social media platforms don't make easy yet.
Eve Fairbank,
So, I think ultimately, Read the piece. If these arguments move you, then we should try to improve, but also sustain this platform because it has been important.
We've been contemplating the future of Twitter and its impact on society. Eve Fairbanks is a Wired contributor who has recently written about the true cost of a Twitter implosion. Eve Fairbanks, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
More Tech Tuesday on the way. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Matthew Rand, sitting in for Ann Fisher today. And earlier this year, California passed a law to punish doctors for spreading false information about COVID-19 vaccines and treatments. The law takes effect in January, but before that, it must get past a pair of legal challenges that argue it unconstitutionally infringes on doctors' First Amendment rights. Stephen Lee Myers writes about misinformation for the New York Times, and he's been covering the story. Stephen Lee Myers, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
It's good to have you here. And first of all, I'm just curious, was there any specific incident or incidences that that led the California legislature to write this law?
There were a number that go back to the beginning of the pandemic, really. And, as you know, the government's response to the pandemic, the recommendations for masking, for, closures and so forth have been controversial, from the very beginning and continue to be. And so a lot of the, when recommendations would come out from the CDC or the government's hospitals and so forth, there were a lot of people challenging them making recommendations that actually were contradictory to what the official guidance or guidelines were. And, the lawmakers who sponsored this bill in California were particularly concerned about those who were essentially telling people or making recommendations to patients that that contradicted the government's advice.
Is there, I wonder what constitutes misinformation in this situation, and when it comes, we all trust our doctor, right? And we rely on them for information about our health. But there's a certain amount of consensus that needs to exist out there in the medical community, right? And when there's dissonance or disagreement, then you have this friction.
I think it's important to define misinformation and disinformation.
Yeah.
Misinformation can be well-intended, but mistaken. And early on in the pandemic, and I think that's the source of a lot of the controversy, there were recommendations that were later changed. And a lot of people said, well, what was the consensus? This was a new virus. We didn't know what was hitting us. And, it took time to figure out the best recommendations. We were all obsessed for at the beginning with not touching anything until we learned that in fact it's airborne, and therefore the recommendations changed over time. And so I think there was a lot of misinformation in the beginning just because we didn't know what was happening. I think with the at least my definition, I think the mainstream definition of disinformation is information that's deliberately intended to mislead somebody. And that can be somebody who's pitching a product and telling you something. And in this case, I think there was a lot of political disinformation that was going on from the White House at the time and in the medical community. And it became highly politicized. And so I think a lot of what this law was aiming to do was to try to just draw a line, at where we would decide that kind of information being passed by a doctor would constitute unprofessional conduct, and thus expose them to, potential penalty.
the California lawmakers, the designers of this law, say they were trying to strike a balance between free speech and public health. How difficult is that? How'd they go about it?
I mean, I think that's the biggest challenge, and it's much bigger than just this law and this issue. You know, is can the government in any instance regulate speech if we know that it's false? And in the case of the law, I think the original intention was doctors who were pushing these alternative treatments, who were telling people that masks weren't necessary, and so forth. I think that they were looking for a very broad way to punish doctors. And there were some prominent ones pushing different agendas, again, for either political or maybe financial interest. But when they sat down and held the hearings and went through the thing, it became very clear early on that you couldn't silence a doctor who went on Twitter or Facebook and said, you know, I disagree. I think the government's wrong in this case. And that they quickly ran into that issue. And so what they did when they were, as the law progressed through the debate, they narrowed it specifically to the doctor-patient relationship, which of course is also confidential. A doctor who, you know, misleads a patient with disinformation, gives them bad advice, and so forth, is exposed. So even before it passed, it was narrowed to address the First Amendment issue. And it's a tricky one. A lot of people that I've talked to on both sides of the political spectrum also, you know, look at this and say, you know, they're uncomfortable with the government saying what you can and can't say in a professional context. And, you know, there are exceptions. You know, you can't, like, for example, advertisers can't mislead people. There are rules against that. And so they were trying to find that balance in the case of medical misinformation.
You can't shout fire in a theater, so to speak.
Exactly.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Matthew Rand, sitting in for Ann Fisher today. And we're talking about a California law that's being challenged that is designed to punish doctors for spreading medical misinformation, especially about COVID-19. Stephen Lee Myers writes about misinformation for the New York Times, where he is a national security correspondent. And Stephen Myers, this law in particular deals with doctors' direct interactions with a patient, as you were alluding to, not their public comments, not something on social media per se. Does that limit the potential impact this law could have should it go into effect?
I think it does. And also, one of the other challenges to the law is that it's unnecessary in a way. I mean, you know, the Medical Board of California, which licensed doctors, already has the ability to punish doctors who, you know, are in some way involved in misconduct, medical misconduct. And so they argue it's not necessary. But I do think, again, that the sponsors and many doctors, including the California Medical Association, you know, endorsed this bill because they wanted to, you know, make it clear that, you know, spreading misinformation in a case of a public health crisis like this is a dangerous thing. It can harm people. It can result in death even. So I think that they were trying to, as I said earlier, draw a line so that, you know, there was some control over what a physician would say.
Yeah. And similarly, the American Medical Association has blamed disinformation for worsening the pandemic's toll. Is there a way to quantify that impact in terms of lives lost or any other way?
I know that there have been some attempts to analyze, you know, people, for example, who didn't take the vaccines. But it's hard to directly link it to, you know, disinformation that's spread. And if so, is it spread on social media or is it on, you know, talk radio or, you know, television and so forth. So there's so many streams of information now that are available to, you know, the ordinary reader, viewer, listener. And I think it's becoming harder and harder to, you know, separate the wheat from the chaff and know, you know, who do believe. And you often hear this, I still hear it now. And, you know, like they, I don't know what is right anymore. And I'm sure you've heard that from people, you know, should I get another booster? Should I not? You know, some people say the boosters have, you know, problems, and it's complicated. And we rely on, you know, trusted sources of information. And, you know, we'd like to think, you know, that that our newspapers, that our radio stations are trusted sources of information. And I think there was a time we thought the government was. And I think there's an incredible amount of distrust now towards anything that comes out of the government from again, both sides of the political spectrum, but I think especially now from the right. And that distrust is what's creating a lot of this problem.
You also spoke to several California doctors who were vocally, you know, opposed to this law. What do they have to say about it?
You know, one of the doctors I spoke to talked about some of the academic research that she's done. And you know, again, as I said, this is an evolving pandemic. We still don't know a lot about this virus, where it started and so forth. We've learned obviously a ton. The vaccines are shown to be effective. But, you know, in her studies, she would find, for example, that for young men, there was an increased chance, of a, you know, bad reaction to the vaccine. And she published these, and she published these in, you know, peer-reviewed journals and so forth, but got an enormous amount of backlash from that, because it was seen as challenging, you know, the status quo, or the medical consensus, which is key because that's what's written into the law. And, you know, part of scientific research, she explained to me quite reasonably, is to challenge consensus, is to seek new information. And I think partly because it's become so politicized, even that kind of scientific debate or research that's been going on, you know, has become a lightning rod for people. And she's been accused of spreading misinformation or disinformation because, you know, for some political agenda. You know, others that I talked to, you know, spoke about, you know, they were trying some of these experimental medicines that have been out there to treat them, but are not FDA approved. And so, you know, and that they say, you know, they've had good results with that. Those studies have shown, you know, that the results don't really show what they say. So, you know, again, there's a debate about what works and what doesn't. And I think that's where honest people can disagree on things. But I think when people are pushing something that they know to be true, untrue, I think that's where you get into the legal issues.
Yeah, and you kind of touch on the politics of all of this, and you wrote in the piece about how red and blue states are moving in opposite directions, right, on this issue of medical misinformation or disinformation. Can you elaborate on that?
You know, several states controlled by Republicans have actually gone to court or passed laws to try to protect people they say who have been silenced by the social media companies. And that's going to become, I think, a huge First Amendment debate you're going to see in the next year or so. There's possibly a case will go to the Supreme Court. You know, can Facebook close your account because you're spreading medical misinformation about the pandemic? And Republican states, Texas, Florida, have passed laws that would in different ways allow people to challenge the lawsuit, which challenges social media companies through lawsuits and so forth. You know, other states, Washington State, California, with this law and others, have been trying to, you know, impose some restrictions on the social media companies. In this case, it's specifically on the medical profession, but in other laws they've looked at, they're trying to find a way, you know, what is the government's role in regulating speech on these platforms? And so it's, and you see a clear divide as you do in other, you know, issues like abortion, for example.
What comes next with the California law and the legal challenges surrounding it?
So in most cases, as I understand it, and I'm not a legal expert by any means, but usually the law would have to take effect before you could challenge it. But these are preemptive challenges. And so in theory, this month, you should see a ruling from one of the two courts. There are two cases in two different courts And you could see an injunction. The plaintiffs are seeking an injunction to prevent the law from taking effect. So, you know, I can't predict how it will go, but you could see an injunction that would suspend the law until a hearing and a final ruling is conducted.
Yeah, and, you know, if something as narrow as this is struck down, is there a lane for a government effort to combat medical misinformation going forward?
I think that's a terrific question. And if this gets knocked down, you know, it's hard to imagine what could pass. You know, if you can demonstrate harm, you know, from you know, speech, you know, and that is protected, then, you know, it's hard to imagine what instance you could regulate that. Even as you alluded to, the famous quote, "You can't yell fire in a movie theater." You know, it's, you know, there's some would make the argument, well, sure you can. And you know, and I think that's the burden that is on society right now, is to kind of figure out where to draw that line. And it's honestly, for the social media companies, I think it's a really tough question, because if you think about the companies like a newspaper, for example, you know, the New York Times can decide what it wants to print. It's not forced to print something that it doesn't believe in or doesn't want to have, and so forth. But I think a lot of people are looking at the companies not as media institutions, but as public utilities, essentially, you know, the public square, like a telephone company. You can't regulate what somebody says on a telephone. And so I think that's going to be also part of the debate that's going to evolve over the next few months.
Yeah, certainly not done with that question. And the last question I have for you, as someone who covers misinformation, do we need to rethink our strategy for combating it? Any thoughts about that?
You know, I've been covering this now since more or less the beginning of the year, and the challenge, I think, is to find an answer to it. And a lot of people are thinking about it. You know, President Obama gave a speech out in Stanford earlier this year. You know, there are academics and think tanks that are devoting tons of resources and time to, you know, what works. And most people come out and with a very, I think, unsatisfying answer of, well, you just combat it with true information. And, you know, that's absolutely, I can't disagree with that. I mean, and that's what we do in our business. But I think the issue is, you know, is there something more that can be done? Because the flow of disinformation on social media today is so overwhelming that anything you do, and you know, give Facebook and until recently Twitter a lot of credit for, you know, policing disinformation. They you know, they've had entire teams devoted to, you know, rooting out malicious and harmful content online. You know, some of which is criminal, by the way. So, you know, they look at this, but there's so much that they can't keep up. And, you know, we've seen it in other languages as well. You know, the flow of information is just too overwhelming, I think. And so the short answer is no, we don't have a good solution to this problem.
And not going away anytime soon. We've been talking about misinformation, disinformation, especially when it comes to the medical field. A law in California seeks to hold doctors accountable. Stephen Lee Myers writes about misinformation for the New York Times. Stephen Lee Myers, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Still more Tech Tuesday on the way. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Matthew Rand, filling in for Ann Fisher today. SpaceX has received permission from the Federal Communications Commission to more than double the number of operational satellites currently orbiting the Earth in the coming years. The company can now move ahead with its plans to launch 7,500 more Starlink broadband internet satellites. At the same time, the FCC deferred action on the company's request for permission to launch a further 22,000 satellites. Here to tell us more is the managing editor for commerce at CNET, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thanks. It's weird to think of 7,500 of something not being enough.
Right, right. Well, and the we'll get to it in a second, but the total number of stuff, or at least working satellites, right, orbiting the Earth at, right now is not that much, really.
It's just shy of 30,000 satellites. And you have to keep in mind that that is GPS companies and communication satellites and like every, you know, kind of thing that is currently flying in low orbit that is, as far as we know, functional. That all adds up to about 30,000 satellites. And so just Starlink is going to be adding 7,500 to that over the next couple of years.
Unbelievable. And give us another sense, you know, what is Starlink? How does it work?
Yeah, so Starlink is a satellite-based internet company. It is one of several efforts to, you know, create a broadband quality internet in places where it's just impossible to run a cable, or in situations where it's been impossible to run a cable. There have been a lot of really positive stories, especially in the last couple of years, around Starlink being deployed in places where it otherwise would have been very difficult for communication, including at least early on in the war with Ukraine and Russia. There had been Starlink efforts in a couple of different places. And that's kind of its big thing, is you can buy this satellite and set it up pretty much wherever you are. It doesn't have to be mounted to something, or, you know, it connects in it. And when you, you pay the, you know, couple hundred bucks a month for the service, it is broadband quality service.
So it's like a couple hundred dollars a month, as opposed to, so they're not necessarily going head to head with terrestrial providers, but it's a solution for when you're in the middle of nowhere and you need to be connected.
Yeah. So, I mean, satellites are expensive. So being able to deliver all of that hardware is certainly an issue with cost. The thing that Starlink has is more or less a first mover advantage here, in that, by the time other companies are firing up competing satellite systems in order to deliver that kind of quality, Starlink will be, very, very good at delivering that internet service. And the FCC is certainly helping that along by allowing this increase. And with that will cause, prices to become competitive once there are other markets, once there are other people competing in the market. But right now, that's not the case.
So what does this FCC authorization mean for parent company SpaceX?
For the moment, it means that SpaceX is going to be the primary contractor in launching those satellites, which is something that Starlink and SpaceX have been working, kind of hand in glove in making sure that those satellites are deployed. Every couple of weeks, it seems, you get a notification if you pay attention to the NASA launch schedule that a Starlink rocket is being deployed and then safely landing back on one of SpaceX's drone ships. So that's something that you can expect to continue over the next couple of years, is essentially once every 2 or 3 weeks, as long as weather is permitting, you'll see some news about a new rocket going up.
And there have been several scientific organizations that have expressed concern about Starlink satellites, that they could interfere with astronomical observations, right, and pose other threats to operations in space. Can you kind of go over what the concern is about these?
Yeah. So early versions of the SpaceX Starlink satellites did not have a special protective coating on them that would make it so that they are harder to see when you are observing the night sky from Earth. And this probably doesn't mean a ton to someone who has a telescope in their backyard. But for astronomers and folks who are a little more active in, you know, the active observing space, especially when it comes to things like time lapses, that many satellites cruising across the sky with no protective coating to stop, you know, reflected light from other sources from stopping, it means that those shots are now incredibly congested with what essentially look like white lines. And if there are enough of them, it's very difficult to see what is on the other side of those white lines. There have been several really jarring photos taken over the last couple of years where what would have otherwise been a really pretty picture is just this crosshatch of white lines that completely cover things. And aesthetic quality aside, it does make, you know, the actual observing of space from Earth a little more difficult each time a new one of those without that coding is launched. That's been fixed. It's been fixed for a little over a year now. But it's still, there are a ton of those satellites up there that currently Starlink does not have a plan to replace.
Yeah, I've seen some of the pictures and videos of people, especially when they first launch, and they're all kind of in a row cruising through the air and or through the sky, I should say, and people not sure what it is, but they're the for early generation Starlink satellites, and I'm hearing that they've fixed that, but those are going to be up there for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I think that their average shelf life was something like 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it could potentially be quite a while before those satellites are being replaced with these others.
And what about the 22,000 or more satellites SpaceX hasn't yet received permission to launch?
Yeah, so I mean that expansion is it's really difficult to even comprehend. If you've seen the movie WALL-E, that scene where they leave Earth comes to mind. But yeah, it's you know, obviously that request was pretty extreme given what we know of how many satellites are already up. But it is a request that I suspect Starlink will continue to make until they get someone to say yes to them.
At some point, there's got to be, you just run out of space in space, right? To have these many satellites.
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, there is you know, we have this kind of low Earth orbit, you know, plan of varying heights and, you know, the next step would be to try and create satellites that are capable of delivering the same kind of information, but from further out.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that is, it, every time you do something like that, it increases in cost to do something like that. So we're gonna need a space traffic controller at some point, I think.
And a space garbage collection service as well. Russell, you also wanted to talk about MyHeritage's AI time machine. Seems like artificial intelligence is having a moment, certainly on social media. What's going on with so this allows you to upload pictures of yourself and see what the AI thinks you'd look like through different historical periods.
Yeah, so this has actually been a really bizarre week for AI in general. There have been a ton of different news stories that came out. You know, the first was actually Disney saying that they have a much easier way to age or de-age actors for upcoming projects in order to kind of change the way someone looks. We also had Instagram's Lenza AI, which is doing something very similar to this MyHeritage, and then it takes a whole bunch of pictures and it shows you how you would look through different kind of artistic lenses. And then this last one, MyHeritage, you know, shows you what you would look like as an astronaut or as an Egyptian prince or, you know, someone in Greece. And it takes, you know, the aesthetic styles of kind of the images of the time and takes a whole bunch of your pictures and creates something new using your facial features.
These are burning questions we've always all had. What would we look like back when? And this, it asks you to upload, so 10 to 25 photos, recommends uploading a mix of images. Why does it need so many?
Yeah, so I mean, it needs so many so that it can accurately show you at different angles, at different lighting, you know, techniques, at different, you know, different facial expressions, so that it's not generating just the same image with a filter on it every time. The goal is to make each image look unique. And, you know, my only real hesitation for any of these projects, if you go in and you play and you join in the kind of sharing on social media what you look like as an astronaut, is to just be aware of the terms of service. You know, MyHeritage and Lenza, you know, they have very specific terms about the artwork that they generate belongs to them and not to you. And so if you are surprised one day because you see an ad for MyHeritage and it happens to be your face on the ad, there's actually nothing you can do about that because you gave them permission to use your likeness when signing up for the service.
Is there anything more nefarious than that with you know, sort of signing, anything more nefarious than signing away your likeness going on with these algorithms?
Yeah, so I mean, this is definitely not the first time we've, you know, algorithms, the trade-off has always been that you are teaching, you know, you're giving them the ability to learn you know, different things and become more capable as you give them kind of this free data and in return they give you these pretty pictures. But yeah, there are some long-term implications for these platforms if they become popular enough to do things like advertise, or if they get bought by a big company in order to, you know, to use that technology for something else, you might accidentally see yourself as a background character in the next Avengers movie if Disney were to buy MyHeritage, which not the worst thing in the world, but you know, I think most people in that situation would be really excited for a paycheck to follow that.
I would think so. Well, all this said, have you given this a try?
I have not. No, I have seen a great many people give them a try, but I don't think my face would look great in a spacesuit anyway. So I'm just going to go ahead and leave my imagination to that.
So where does this go from here? This kind of technology, where is it headed?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, the next thing, you know, for this kind of technology really becomes a way to monetize it. And there are some companies that have said, hey, we'll let you use this technology to make pretty pictures of yourself if you give us $8 or something like that. That's not really the monetization strategy. The next step is going to be someone like Coca-Cola, you know, buying access to this and having one of the filter options being you sitting amongst some of the Coca-Cola polar bears with a Coke in your hand, you know, like that kind of thing. The trade-off there being that company would have access to all of this data that is now that you have now given them. So, you know, the monetization thing is definitely the thing that comes next to these companies figuring out how they can, you know, kind of get in on this and make money on it. And we've yet to see just quite how deep that well goes.
So all right.
That'll be a thing for next year, I suspect.
User beware. Finally, you wanted to talk about the pending departure of Slack CEO Stuart Butterfield. He'll be leaving in January. Why is this important?
Yeah. So if you work in an office, there's a reasonable chance you either use Microsoft Teams or Slack. There's not usually a whole lot of in between there. And in the middle of all of the, you know, kind of at home excitement for, you know, workers during pandemic times, Salesforce, a huge company responsible for, you know, massive tools that loads of companies all around the world use for, you know, customer management and things like that, bought Slack. Now, one of the really interesting things about Slack in the last year is that even though it was bought by this giant company who has a history of monetizing lots and lots of the different projects that they acquire, Slack has actually remained pretty much the same since its acquisition. There have been very little additions or modifications to the way that Slack behaves. And a lot of that has been attributed to its CEO staying in place after the Salesforce acquisition. You know, being able to kind of stick around and help guide the platform has been, you know, kind of one of the things that was seen as a positive. And as of the end of this year, that will not be the case. The folks at Salesforce will essentially have the entire ownership of the Slack platform. And so it's likely that here in the next year, we'll start seeing some substantial changes to the way it functions.
All right. So we're seeing some shakeup with the leadership. They're saying this is all just weird timing, though. Do you think that's the case?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting, you know, point in history as far as tech companies are concerned, that there was a lot of kind of overstaffing in the wake of the pandemic. A lot of these tech companies deciding that they could ramp up and really kind of take advantage of the situation while everyone was at home. You know, Salesforce buying one of the biggest communication tools available to most businesses was not an accident. And now all of these you know, things are returning to not normal, but you know, kind of less chaotic and less stuck at home. And with that comes this sort of relaxing of you know, buying habits and things like that. So all of these companies are now letting these folks go. You know, Facebook had this massive set of layoffs, but you know, the addendum to that layoff, you know, surge that got so many headlines last week, was that the number of employees that they have now is still more than they had before lockdown started. You know, so that is as terrible it is to see a lot of layoffs. And in many cases, when it comes to these larger companies, it is a correction from overstaffing that happened during COVID. And you know, Salesforce is going to want to do what they can to take advantage of companies that are still using Slack on a daily basis.
All right. And a ubiquitous program, certainly growing more so. Russell Holley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Matthew Rand on 89.7 NPR News.